The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Hannah Dillon, staff writer at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by content strategist Joe Redfern. Thanks for joining us, Joe. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It's a delight.
Absolute pleasure to have you here. Also on the podcast this week is ExchangeWire Head of Content and Succession Superfan, John Still. Hi, John.
Hi, Hannah. If it is to be said, so it be, so it is. Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Always a pleasure. Lovely. Thanks both for joining us this week. I'll start us off with the first story of the week, which is that streaming subscriptions have risen in the UK, up 4.1% in March, according to Barclays. The increase, which marks digital content subscriptions' highest year-on-year growth in 5 months, comes as consumers cut back on discretionary spending, including on nights out, to manage the rising cost of living. According to figures from Barclays, spending rose just 4% last month, with over half of consumers cutting back on things like new clothes and eating at restaurants. While Mother's Day gave retailers a boost, estimates suggest that the coronation weekend will prove disappointing for leisure and hospitality businesses. Joe, I'll come to you first on this story. Mm-hmm. How secure do you think the future of streaming is in the UK and elsewhere?
Well, they do say that billionaires are made during recessions, right? And that is certainly true when it comes to consuming content. The one thing that typically stays robust in a recession is TV watching, or at least content consumption, I think we would qualify that as now. And you think about it, in the pandemic, that was huge for platforms like Disney Plus. You know, on the one hand, they had to lay off all of their parks and live event staff. On the other hand, Disney Plus went off like a rocket. Same for platforms like Roblox. People stayed in and started gaming. Roblox's fortunes in the pandemic, that was the real supercharged growth of their platform. However, I think we need to put it in context. And I would urge a note of caution when you read stats like subs growth has grown in March. We're reaching saturation, I guess. If you think about the total addressable market for subscriptions, we're more or less there in terms of saturation. So streamers now are looking less at subs growth. What we did see at the end of 2022 is the end of a decade of uninterrupted subs growth. So as you pointed out, Hannah, with your article there, while subs have grown in March, actually, it's been a bit tricky in the last 12 months in terms of subscription growth. So what's happening to the SVOD players? They're looking less at subs growth now. Now they're looking at reducing churn. The metrics have shifted slightly. How do they prevent that cutting of subscriptions, particularly as you point out, in a time of in an economic downturn, and people are looking at the opportunity cost of spending, going out is suffering more, as you said. So what does that mean? We typically see an increase in spend on programming to try and reduce that churn. And there are other levers that SVOD platforms are beginning to pull, such as gaming. I think we might be touching on that slightly later. So in a nutshell, whilst it looks positive in the short term, as the headline suggests, that subscriptions grew in March, I think it's important to say that actually it's still quite challenging for the subscription market, because we've reached saturation with the total addressable market. They're trying to figure out how to stem churn. And actually, companies like Amazon Prime and Disney Plus are looking at other areas of their business that they can bundle in, again, to keep users on their platforms. You've got Amazon Prime, well, Prime Delivery. That's a great product that they can bundle in with their content to reduce churn. Disney Plus too, they should be looking at discounts in parks if you stay a Disney Plus subscriber. So this kind of bundling, lifestyle bundling, as media commentator Evan Shapiro calls it, is another interesting way that the SVOD platforms are looking to stem that churn. So yes, positive in March for subs growth, but it's within a wider context of pressure on these SVOD platforms.
John, what about you? What do you think about this?
Yeah, I can only echo what Joe said, really, in that it's this news, it looks good. It is positive for the streaming services. But it sort of flies in the face of a lot of what we've been hearing in the industry and what we've been seeing in terms of like what the general public are doing. We have reached a saturation point. We do have a fragmented TV ecosystem now with a lot of different platforms competing for attention. And the overriding thing that we've been hearing before this news is that people are choosing more judiciously between the services. They are, you know, picking one another rather than subscribing to Netflix, to Amazon, to Disney, to Paramount, to HBO, you know, all the services that you can now get that come at around the same price point per month. So it's interesting to see that streaming is up. And that's in the economic environment we have at the moment, that people are choosing to still subscribe and that those numbers are going up. But no, agree totally with Joe on the caveats that have to come with that and how the streaming services themselves are approaching their audiences.
Joe, I'll come back to you on this with a follow-up question. How are brands navigating their messaging during the cost of living crisis?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to value, doesn't it? That's the thing that we're all looking at when we're making decisions on spending currently. What value am I getting from this? And still, subscriptions seem relatively good value. Most of my work happens in the kids and youth media space. You think about a Disney Plus subscription. For the grown-ups, you've got all of the Star Wars back catalogue and spin-offs on there. That's stuff that I grew up with. I still like watching. For the kids, you've got all of the kids' content on there. If you were to take the family to on a night out to the cinema, it could be the best part of 40, 50 quid. So actually, a subscription to Disney Plus then starts looking at like value. Now, that, again, is within the context of the average number of subscriptions a family has is reducing. So how do you then articulate that value to your customers and not just to a subset of your customers? You know, Disney Plus does tend to be thought of as a much, you know, it's a platform for kids, really, but actually it's not. It's got a huge, huge catalog. So it's about articulating that value for the whole family. Netflix is predicated on choice. You know, when you're at home because you can't necessarily go out, there is this unprecedented amount of choice on the Netflix menu. I mean, to some extent, so much choice, it's often difficult to figure out what you're going to choose. But in, you know, we're used to being served this huge smorgasbord of content. So that's for me, I think, is Netflix's message. And that's what they've always promoted. But similarly, they're now looking at games and beginning to target families that are heavy gamers. We know in the youth space, gaming is taking up a much higher proportion of time than video. So Netflix is starting to see that messaging. You don't have to leave Netflix if you want a gaming fix. Here we've got it. So there's subtle differences in messaging for each one of the platforms as they shore up their positioning, I guess.
Yeah. John, anything to add?
No, again, agree. It's the play seems to be all about keeping you in their ecosystem. Joe and I discussed last week, you know, Disney is something that I can justify to my family for a number of different reasons, but also it is squarely aimed at me in my late 30s who enjoys Star Wars, likes the nostalgia stuff. But then it's also got, you know, loads of, you know, I can watch Blueys on there. There's loads of things for my kid as well. So it's interesting how what they seem to want to do, and this does play really nicely into Netflix and gaming, is not just have a TV subscriber, but to keep you spending as much time and, importantly, keeping your attention in their own proprietary ecosystem. I think that's like how they're looking at stuff. From the marketing point of view, we saw in the IPA Bellwether report that came out this morning for Q1 that there is, you know, for the first time in a year, we're seeing projections of growth in marketing budgets, 8%. It's up 8% on where it was this time last year. And main media advertising, which includes TV, is up 4.4% on the last quarter. So TV advertising is still being seen as an important play.
Excellent. Well, I'll take us on to our second story of the week, which is that Google has announced an updated version of Google TV, which will see the CTV platform aggregate content from over 800 free ad-supported streaming TV channels or FAST channels. The change will allow viewers to browse programs from both linear channels, which Google has distribution rights for, and from virtual multi-channel video programming distributors that have partnered with the tech giant. The upgrade will allow viewers to explore content from FAST providers that Google has integrated with, such as Pluto TV, Plex, and Tubi, alongside Google's own selection of channels, all within the same platform. The update could lay the groundwork for the search giant to launch its own branded channels, although it's unclear whether Google has any plans to do so. So I'll come to you first, John, on this story. How do you think this update might affect Google's position within the FAST space? And what impacts could this have on competing providers?
I'm going to sort of repeat my last answer in terms of keeping you in their ecosystem. This seems to be a play for, Google seeing the trend. We've covered a lot this year in terms of the growth of FAST and what we're seeing in terms of Netflix and Disney having an advertising proposition now through their channels. And Google seem to be jumping on this and making it central to their own proposition. It's an interesting move. There's a lot there. 800 channels is, that's a vast bank of content that people can go on. And with that level of choice, pick and choose what they're watching. In terms of the impact on competing providers, I mean, this is like always going to be the question around any level that we discuss with Google is competitive behavior, what space they leave in the market for other players, whether this is the beginning of a new consolidation across FAST channels and then becoming part of this bigger Google FAST experience. So yet to be seen, I suppose, on what it will mean for the competing providers. But it's no surprise that Google have decided, given that, you've got Android TVs on any smart TV as well, you'll have the Google opportunity. So it is, no surprise to see, just interesting on what it actually will mean for competition going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, what do you think? What do you think this means for Google's position within FAST?
I think this is their big play, and this is the beginning of them making a statement. And this is their play in that TV and channel space. What's interesting is they're doing it at a time when, as we've just said, free is becoming even more important as families globally, internationally, are cost cutting. Free becomes much more attractive. And here's Google with a whole 800 FAST channels. So interesting that it's happened now. Now, I'm sure it's been in the works for a long time, but a smart move at this point in time by Google. What's interesting is, for me, FAST channels in the TV and distribution business, they're kind of cool. Everybody wants a FAST channel. Everybody's launching a FAST channel. 800 of them. There, again, going back to that issue of total addressable market, there's only so many eyeballs, then I would say that actually I expect FAST channel casualties in the next 12 months. A lot of consolidation. There's going to be a lot that don't cut the mustard and that perhaps don't survive. That said, what's interesting to me, having observed trends in the content distribution market and the TV market over the last few years, we've gone from the age of linear TV. And again, I go back to my days at the BBC and Disney, where you've got curated linear channels, curated by specialists in kind of a kid's day part. You usually had an energetic lunchtime, but then you've got bedtime hour, curated by, a kid's needs during the day in their developmental stage. Then we moved out of linear and off to YouTube and these platforms that have the unprecedented choice that we've just spoken about. But that unprecedented choice came with scattergun viewing. And parents, particularly with kids media, were watching things that perhaps weren't right for their child's frame of mind or day parts. It was too energetic. It was winding them up. They were going crazy. Or it was too old for them, too young for them. What FAST channels I see really doing and doing well is we're coming back to this age of curation. We've seen Sky Kids launch a curated channel. We see on fast channels, niche channels, channels that are based around horror or niche interests. Actually, people are fed up having so much choice. It's nice on the face of it. But when you cannot decide what to choose, you have this choice paralysis. Actually, having a channel that caters to what you love and that actually reduces the choice and curates it with a little bit of thought and care and attention, I'm seeing a resurgence in that in terms of people's demand for viewing. And that's where I think fast channels will really clean up. Back down towards niche, cater to audiences, because when you're thinking about the ad dollars and the ad spend that you mentioned, John, you know, a smaller audience, but a niche and engaged audience, if you can target them correctly, you will have much more chance of monetizing them than if you are trying to monetize and advertise to a mass audience and you will only hit a relatively small amount of them. So what's interesting to me is, yes, free. Google's gone big on a free play. Nailed it. You know, we're all thinking about what we can possibly get for free. But what's interesting is I think we'll see a lot fall by the wayside, but I think we will see niche curated channels start to become the superstars. And that would be my prediction.
Thinking about this story in the context of our previous story, which was about the recovery somewhat of streaming channels of SVOD, albeit with some serious caveats, what kind of impact do you think Google's Play could have on the recovery of those SVOD services? Joe, I'll come to you first.
I think it puts pressure on them. You know, everybody's been waiting for what Google's Play will be. We've got Apple TV Plus. They seem to, they're concentrating on, certainly in my view, they seem to concentrate on smaller but much higher quality content. Certainly true of kids. Again, do most of my work in the kids space and I see that. So again, each one is trying to own a niche. They've got a USP that's coming through in their marketing at this time when their messaging has to justify its value and its place in people's lives. So for me, I think Google's is we're here now, and hey, we're free and we've got everything. But actually, you might also stumble on a channel there that really talks to your core interests, whether it's retro movies from the 80s, whether it's food programs, we can deliver to you. And I think that's quite a canny move, because it takes that it takes that kind of trouble out of having too much choice. And that seems like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Everybody seems, you know, says we want more choice, but actually there comes a point where we want someone to do the thinking for us. And I think maybe Google is then extending that into their messaging, saying, we've got a channel for you. We've got channels for everyone, but we have a channel for you. And I think that's a really interesting play from them.
Yeah, absolutely. John, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, it's that next level of personalization, I suppose. To, you know, it's, people have, we've gone through the linear era where TV was served to you at the time that the networks put it on. We've moved into the streaming era where there is now unbridled choice, and it's sometimes stymieing, as Joe mentioned. You know, it's the old adage that you spend more time on Netflix looking for your next film than you do actually watching it. But fast is a tick back in the other direction, and towards people wanting free to start with, but also in, you know, like a channel that has the stuff they like on. What Joe mentioned about that, the niche audiences, is very, very important going forward for advertising, especially in terms of curation and being where your audience is. If, say, you're a film studio putting a horror film in the pictures that you want people to go and see, then you're going to advertise it on a channel that has a dedicated horror channel, because your people are going to see it. And it's incredibly important. And it's what we're seeing permeate across a lot of the industry, not just in TV. This curation, this niche audience targeting is very important. And I think, yeah, this is Google's big step towards providing that for a lot of different niche audiences.
Mm. And something else that just came to mind, having read the article that you referenced, Hannah, the one smart tactic that I spotted was that Google is giving you the opportunity to favorite channels. So again, instead of scrolling through 800 fast channels, you can favorite your favorite channels, and then up they go to the top. And again, at a time when customer acquisition costs are you know, increasing, budgets are under pressure, what a great way to be able to target your niches and make those ad spend work even harder.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. I'll take us on to our final story of the week, which we've actually touched upon a little bit earlier on, which is that Netflix has revealed its ambition to release a further 40 video games by the end of 2023. The streaming giant, which boasts over 200 million global subscribers, first moved into gaming in 2021. The company has already launched 55 games from independent studios and household name Ubisoft. Netflix's various in-house studios are reportedly working on 16 games, and a further 70 are in development among the streamers' partners. Netflix VP of External Games, Leanne Loom, told Axios that the company plans to partner with more large-scale publishers and will invest in more exclusive games, which have proved popular. Despite Netflix's enthusiasm, the gaming industry has proved a tough nut to crack for other tech and entertainment firms before it, with Google recently shuttering its Stadia gaming platform due to a lack of player interest. So I'll come to you first on this, John. Could Netflix succeed in gaming, or could it suffer the same fate as Google Stadia?
It could definitely succeed in gaming. I think that they've seen the possibility, and you know, they've seen that they have to diversify their offering. As we've mentioned, they're under increasing competition in the TV market in an increasingly fragmented TV ecosystem. And the push into gaming, which I know Joey can talk to a lot, you know, more in depth than I can, in terms of the effect of gaming and the impact of gaming and the opportunity of gaming, I think they might have hit the right time. Google Stadia was obviously not a success by any means, and the fear would be that they go the same way, that they overextend at the wrong time. But it seems that Netflix are taking the right steps at the right pace to do this. I've played Netflix's mobile games. It's interesting for me, as the most casual of casual gamers, that when I see it's their brand, then I sort of trust it as a game. Like, I don't like going into the App Store and picking at random, because I don't trust what I'm putting on my phone, and the possibilities of safety with that as well. But when I see it's on Netflix, and you know, I know that there won't be intrusive advertising across my game and stuff like that, it's a natural choice. So I think between their brand and their proposition, that's done right, they could really nail a niche in the market.
Joe, what do you think? Do you think Netflix could make a success of this move into gaming?
I do. I would echo what John has said. They've leaned into it at a time when many other big companies would shutter their games division, would lay people off. We know it's in the context of big layoffs at Meta and Google. No, they're sticking with it. They might not be making quite as many as they'd originally planned, but they're sticking with it. And that tells me that Netflix knows how important gaming, and particularly casual gaming, is to a large proportion of its audience and its subscribers. Currently, less than 5% of its subscribers go on and play the games on Netflix. But they know that the general trend is that an ever older demographic is spending more time on gaming. Again, in the kids and youth space, we know that they spend more time gaming than they do watching video. So it tells me that Netflix is being quite prescient. They are future-proofing their audience and their subscribers by adopting the same approach as they do with video. Let's go for choice. They want to add another 40 games by year end. Actually, they're notching up into, I think they're going to hit three figures soon in terms of the number of games. So you've got choice there. And again, when we come back to this metric of time spent, you don't have to leave and go and boot up a console. There's some games on Netflix for the casual gamer, like, you know, kind of me and many others. So delivering games to your TV or your device, if you watch on phone, very much feels like a value add. Back to that value proposition that we were speaking about before, in a time of cost cutting, another tick for value add for Netflix in that it's offering you gaming. You don't, like I said, it's there. Where that differs from Google Stadia's business model is that I think Google Stadia was rather more fractured. You've got some subscriptions, some full price games. It wasn't very clear. This proposition by Netflix is very clear. So yes, serve your customers everything that they want. And increasingly that is games alongside video content. Keep it on platform, make it value add. And I think that that does tell me that Netflix has realized how much more important gaming will be in the future. And they're not going to jump out of it now that we're in this economic blip. They're going to lean into it. And I genuinely think that it's a super smart move by them. I know there's a lot of people head scratching, thinking, why are they still backing this games business? I think potentially in 5 years' time, everybody will be saying, wow, Netflix really got it right, didn't they?
It's interesting. You both touched upon the timing of this move from Netflix. The announcement of the step further into gaming comes, you know, at a time where they've reported quite mixed results for the first quarter of this year. And also they had a very challenging 2022, moved into launching an ad-supported tier. With all this in mind, do you think it's possible that a move to gaming now is a little bit of a gamble for Netflix, or are you quite convinced it is a smart move and will work out for them? Joe, I'll stick with you first.
Yeah, you're right. I think in the short term, it looks risky. And I'm sure they're thinking about how they might temper their ambitions in this space versus the press releases they were putting out last year, you know, 55 new games. Actually, maybe it'll only be 30 or 40. But currently, and they might prove me wrong after the current earnings call, currently it feels like it's a part of their strategy that they're not willing to see just yet. And I think that is smart. You know, knee-jerk reactions can, you know, they happen a lot. We see that with the layoffs in some of these big studios and big tech companies. But I do feel like Netflix, someone somewhere has said, no, we need to stick with gaming, guys. We need to just hold our nerve. And that feels, for me, certainly the right play. Again, when you look at other platforms like Roblox, you know, they are a competitor to Netflix. Netflix's competitors are not just other SVODs or AVODs. Actually, it's Roblox. You know, Roblox moved from niche platform to now a mainstream entertainment platform where young people are going to hang out. And it's not just kids. Their largest growth sector is 17 to 24-year-olds. So it's a social space they're hanging out. They're going on there to listen to music, attend gigs, concerts. Spotify launched Spotify Island on there, you know, music. They're going on there to interact with their favorite brands. You can watch content on Roblox. You can go on there and, you know, they've previewed Star Wars trailers on there. So mainstream entertainment platform, huge dwell time, back to dwell time again. You look at kids' behaviors, they spend almost twice as long on Roblox as they do on YouTube. The analysts at Netflix are going to know these behaviors. So again, that for me, that gaming play plays into that. Keep them in the ecosystem, as John pointed out.
John, anything to add?
I do feel it's the right time. And what I see at the moment, I think it's the right move. It's interesting how they've done it. I think they're doing it well. I'll veer off in a little bit of conjecture here as well in terms of how prescient the move is. They might have an eye on IP. They might want to hit the next Mario Brothers. They might think that if they stay in gaming, then they'll hit the next Sonic, which then becomes the next Netflix movie franchise, becomes the next Netflix series. And you've got a kid who's whatever the Netflix totem character like Mario or Sonic might be. They've got it. And then the players who played it when it was a little platform game all of a sudden are subscribing to Netflix to watch the movie, watch the series. I think gaming IP is hugely interesting at the moment in terms of its role in the future of entertainment. And I wonder if Netflix have, you know, again, purely conjecture, but whether they have in mind that maybe they'll strike the next big character, the next thing, like the next cross-generational hit. Yes, I think it's correct to stay in gaming. I think they have the potential to really exploit the market. Their lunch has been thoroughly eaten by their competitors in the TV streaming market. And yeah, why not? it's not a moonshot. It's very much grounded in potential. So I'd like to see how it plays out.
Excellent. Well, fantastic. I'll take us on to our second half of the podcast, which is to talk to you more a little bit, Joe, about the kind of work you do, about your role as a content strategist. So to start off, could you give us an outline of the kind of work you're doing at the moment, what you've worked on in the past? You've mentioned focusing in on children's media. So if you could just give us an outline.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, gosh, I've been 20 years. Ooh, that makes me shudder. 20 years working largely in the kids media space. So, you know, again, referencing those trends that we just spoke about, you know, when I first started, kids media happened on the TV, you know, in the lounge, on that big square set in the corner of the room. And that's where content was broadcast from, and that's how kids consumed it. And in the intervening period, we've seen massive shifts away from linear broadcast into SVODs, into YouTube, and kids' behaviors have changed drastically. I mean, really now, what's interesting for me, essentially, I'm an IP builder. I love scaling IP, distributing it in terms of gaining number of eyeballs, extending into merch. That kind of franchise IP building is my passion. How that happens now is very different to how it happened 15, 20 years ago. You know, you either had your movie or your TV show. If it did rather well, you know, you would create, you know, when apps became popular, you'd create an app. And everything happened in a very formulaic way. There was a playbook and it was quite linear. And then ultimately, maybe 2-3 years later, you would extend into merch if you felt that it was going to be successful. Fast forward to now, and if kids discover a new brand or young people discover a new brand, they want content served on every single platform they're on relating to that brand. So no longer can IP creators and builders create IP in that very formulaic linear fashion. To paraphrase the movie, you've got to put everything everywhere all at once, because kids are platform agnostic. They're on multiple platforms often at the same time. If my kids are anything to go by, at least two, sometimes three, they're able to split their attention. And so if you are to build an IP within this context of unprecedented numbers of IP and that noise that we spoke about that comes with choice, then you have to build an IP with a multi-platform strategy in mind, get everything out there all at once from as early as possible, if not day one, whether it's a Roblox game or a Fortnite island, video content on YouTube, podcast content, your Snap filter's already good to go, your TikTok strategy in place. That is how creators and builders make IP at the moment. What's interesting for me is it still confuses a lot of people. And I don't mean that in a patronizing way, but big, huge studios aren't set up to act that nimbly. You know, movies and IP take time to create. And this is where we see the rise of the creator economy and creator-led brands. And that's fascinating. Look at Mr. Beast, the world's biggest YouTuber. He has Feastables, his chocolate line. It's huge. It's in every Walmart in the States. You know, these creator-led brands, because they know how to grow audiences on these platforms, are stealing a march, whilst the bigger, perhaps more traditional and established players figure out what they're going to do with kids living their lives in this space. I hesitate to use the word metaverse. I know it's become a very uncool term. Whether you really kind of believe in the metaverse or not, really, the metaverse as a notion is just the fact that people will mirror their hobbies, their lives, their loves, their interests in real life in a digital space. Ultimately, hopefully, everything will be interconnected and interoperable, and your identity and what you do will follow you around that space. But actually, kids are already doing it. This is why I love working in the kids' media business, because you're almost in the future game, because they're way ahead of us. We're just running to catch up. And that's what's interesting to me, is they're already doing that. We see evidence in reports and trends that a kid's digital identity now has reached parity in terms of its importance to them as their physical identity. So they're looking at buying new Nike Air Force Ones, but they also want a digital version for their avatar. They're playing with their identity online, much like we did as teenagers when you dyed your hair pink and you wore only black for 6 months. You know, I joke, but that it's so it's same developmental stages, the same things, but now they're being done online or in and out of that digital world, the metaverse, if you will. That is super interesting to people like me, who would then have to figure out, how do you build new IP, new content, new characters, new storytelling worlds with that in mind? Because the way that they consume them is so very different. And there isn't a playbook. Nobody's written one yet. And arguably it changes so frequently as new platforms become popular, as new ways for kids to create and interact and consume content emerge. It's tricky. And so I try and help content creators and companies in that space navigate how to reach their audience across those platforms and hopefully be able to scale an IP in this sea of millions of IP.
Yeah, it sounds like a really fascinating area. As you stated, there is no playbook really for children's media at this stage. And it sounds like an area with a huge amount of flux and flexibility. Nonetheless, do you at this stage have any predictions for where the area, where their space could go in the next couple of years?
John mentioned the rise of gaming IP. And again, many years ago, most IP either came from a movie or it came from books. Literary estates were mined, were a huge source of IP. Roald Dahl, you know, that's where a lot of IP came from. And then, you know, we get into TV land, and as the number of platforms increased, we had huge big TV franchises popping. Then gaming, which had always been a bit of an outlier. And I think there was an inherent snobbery from video kind of movie makers and TV makers that gaming perhaps was a little bit lowbrow. So off it sat to the side, and never the twain shall meet, gaming and content creation and TV and movies, sat largely separate. There was the odd intersection, but, you know, the movies often flopped because, again, they couldn't necessarily secure the big enough budgets, the best writers. And then here we are, young people spend more time gaming, and even older generations, the percentage of their time spent gaming is on the increase. And now everybody's really looking at gaming IP. Again, I come back to Roblox. Roblox has 62, 63 million daily active users. That's a huge number of people. They are playing everything from big, shiny Sonic the Hedgehog multi-million dollar games to a game developed by a developer, teenage developer in their bedroom who's grown up on the platform, who knows what levers to pull, the game mechanics that people love. That is spawning new superstar IP on that platform. So you might have heard of Adopt Me. You might have heard of Welcome to Bloxburg. You've got Twilight Daycare. Those are IP that in the old, you know, kind of in times gone by, studios would have given their right arm to have built, to be reaching that many people on a daily basis. And think of the potential to expand that out with storytelling into universes. And it's no surprise that all of a sudden we're seeing this combining of gaming IP, how it's become kind of very popular in terms of mining places like Roblox for new IP that content creators can then option the TV rights for, the movie rights for. We will see many brands grow from Roblox, and I think that will only, that will only grow. Again, creator IP, creator-led IP is another prediction of mine. Again, we talked about Mr. Beast. We can see it. You've got the Sidemen, who are releasing records that are getting into the charts. We've got okay, you started in movies, but you know, you've got Ryan Reynolds with gin and mobile phone companies. You know, anyone with an audience and with influence, and particularly the younger ones that have grown up on these platforms, on YouTube, across Roblox, who know intimately their audience and the behaviors of their audience, are delivering direct to the audience. It's a direct to consumer play. Why do a deal with a licensing agency where you give away a lot of your IP, you're subject to their marketing strategies? You can go direct to your audience. And that's what the Sidemen and Mr. Beast are doing. So I see many more creator and influencer-led brands going direct to their audience in the future. And again, I don't think we've seen the last of gaming IP. I think Mario is the start of probably a couple of years of a lot of gaming IP across TV and movies.
You recently published an article concerning the Edgeverse and how online platforms like YouTube and TikTok are increasingly becoming the source of children's education. How are you seeing, I mean, we've talked about gaming, but how are you seeing gaming platforms, social platforms, and also Web3 tech attracting kids' attention?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's where they're hanging out. And what we see, again, you know, kids are going to these platforms for information, not necessarily education with a big E. That happens at school, right? When they come home and they're on these platforms, they're there primarily for entertainment. However, don't be fooled. They're quite happy if they leave a platform or a piece of content with a little bit more knowledge and information than they had than before they interacted with that content or platform. And this is where my passion for education comes in, is that there's a huge skills gap. We know that kids leave school and there's a massive skills gap between what they're taught at school and what businesses of the future require. McKinsey have done a lot of writing on this. Where are kids going to develop those skills? They're going to Roblox. They're going to YouTube. We Google stuff. We grew up Googling things if we wanted to know it. They YouTube it, or even now they TikTok it. And it can be everything from how do I boil an egg? How do I hang a shelf in my first dorm room at college? What's crypto? How do I make money? They go to those platforms for that information. What makes me a little bit sad is that there is a dearth of good quality content made that does empower, that does inform, that does equip young people with the skills to plug that skills gap, to go on and be successful in life. There's precious little of that. There's heaps of YouTubers hawking crypto schemes or playing games. You know, that's fine, because again, like I said, young people are primarily there to be entertained. What there should be more of is good quality, entertaining, well animated, well written, well produced, well filmed content that actually helps empower young people and inform them and equip them with the knowledge that they're going to need in the future. So that's a kind of passion project of mine. I do get on my soapbox about it frequently, is how can we apply that franchise brand methodology that we spoke about? You know, how can we apply that same strategy that would be applied to Disney projects or the Minions and apply it to content that actually within that delivers against those things for young people too? Because it's not that they don't want it, they're hungry for it, but it just has to be done in a different way, not in an earnest way, not in an overly preachy or educational way. Just make good stuff, but make good stuff that delivers those things that kids are searching out on these platforms. So that's really where my passion for this edutainment, and I cringe even saying the word, I think it needs a redefinition or even a new word. We should perhaps think of one. But that kind of content, it needs to be made, and it needs to be made. And, you know, that's one thing that I'm hoping to do with the partners that I'm working with in the future.
Well, that takes us to the end of this week's Mad Tech podcast. Jo, thanks so much for joining us. That was a really thorough, very informative chat. Lovely to have you.
Thank you. Super interesting. My grey matter is firing on all cylinders now. Thank you.
Wonderful. Excellent. And John, thanks again for joining as well.
Pleasure as always. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for listening. See you next week.